Cashiers sort through large stacks of money. Yemen's central bank has become another front line in this war. The bank's headquarters was moved from the capital Sana'a in the year 2016. The government not recognized by the Yemenis accused the legitimate government of Yemen, the National Salvation Government, that it was using its resources to finance the war. But this was just another effort by the Saudis and its allies to squeeze the Yemenis. The relocation of the bank made the situation worse, since it divided the country. As one analyst put it, it left the country with two parallel centers of fiscal policy dealing with one currency.
Time to begin our first guest of today's show. Her name is Judith Brown, and she is a former manager at UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She was the manager at Refugee Health Project in Yemen until the year 2001, and she also has a Facebook page on Yemen, which is good to see. Judith, welcome. The destruction of Yemen is something that is truly devastating and shocking. When we take a look at the way that the Saudi bombing campaign has happened for 6 years, I mean, this country was a poor country to begin with, and you have an economy that's in tatters, and the bombing campaign is said to have targeted vital infrastructure, which is my focus on this question, roads and hospitals, for example. Was that done with the aim of actually destroying the economy so that the people would rise up against the National Salvation Government there, do you think?
I think that one has to say that the Yemen economy has been targeted in many ways from the beginning, not only by bombing campaign, but by the embargo, by the movement of banks, by restriction of money in North Yemen. And yes, it has. In fact, I think one of the things that you didn't mention is its particular attack on the agricultural industry, everything to do with it, markets, farms, animal livestock, warehouses, factories that produce food. They've all been targeted by this OD campaign, and that's been quite well documented. And certainly it has had the result of Yemen's economy being totally destroyed. I think that, was it on purpose? I think my own feeling is that that was a target, because I think that modern warfare doesn't aim to necessarily win wars, but to destroy companies and keep those countries in a perpetual state of war.
Indeed, that could be the case. Thank you, Judith. We're going to definitely come back to you a little later in this program. Well, it's time to take a look at our second report of this program, which takes a look at one of the consequences of this war, food insecurity and its impact on the national economy.
A hungry child, malnourished due to prolonged lack of food. Shortages of water.
Central bank is out of money. The price of the basic food basket, the things you need as a family in order to survive, has increased by 30% in just the past few weeks alone, and it's continuing to increase. These are the same sets of factors that drove the country to the brink of famine 18 months ago.
The world has failed the Yemeni people.
To seize this chance to revitalize the political process that we now hope we can see in front of us.
But the will of the Yemenis is still there as they welcome the holy month of Ramadan. Sana'a residents said they gave the Muslim holy month a great reception. People have flocked to the supermarkets for their Ramadan needs. However, not all Yemenis are as lucky, as in the legitimate capital Sana'a, run by the National Salvation Government. Yemenis see them as the legitimate governing body of the country. They have pledged a commitment to them.
Our guest for this section is Mia Shua. She earned her PhD in political economy from the University of Sydney and has written many articles, one of them titled Revisiting Neoliberalism and Democracy in a Time of Crisis. Mia, welcome to the program. Yemen is said to be so broken that it can never be put back together again. Take the Yemen Central Bank, for example, split into two by the self-proclaimed president of Yemen, Abdel Mazhar Hadi. That's resulted in trades at one rate in the National Salvation Government-controlled capital like Sana'a, and then another raid in SCC-controlled Aden. That's the Southern Transitional Council. Basically, this seems to be an effort to break the country into two parts. Is that what the aim is?
The fragmentation of state institutions is an unfortunate but expected outcome of this ruthless war. You could argue that the government's efforts to hold on to power and suffocate the Houthi movement at all costs has perpetuated this fragmentation and intensified it. The relocation of the bank is part of a government plan to bring the banking system in Yemen under the control, under its control, and deprive the Houthis of millions of dollars acquired from taxes from Sana'a-based banks and mobile operators. The president's move sparked an economic war between the two banks, as the Houthis refused to pay salaries of public servants in areas under their control and banned banknotes printed by the Yemeni government in Aden. It was said that the cuts in salaries had a severe economic toll. However, despite the Yemeni government efforts to control the exchange system, the Yemeni rial on Thursday moved towards a new record low in the government-controlled areas.
Okay, thank you, Mia. That's Mia Shua with her thoughts there. So it's time to take a break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up, so stay right where you are. Let's welcome back guest Judith Brown, the former manager of UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Judith, we're going to take a look at the port city of Aden and my question here, which is under Saudi Emirati siege, not letting the flow of goods freely into the country. The Saudis and its allies, they are not capable of winning this war. Why don't they settle for a political solution instead of destroying the country, placing a siege on Aden, and continuing this war in which they are not only losing, but they're choking the economy as a result?
Well, I think that one of the things is that powers outside Yemen don't seem to want Yemen to end the war. Certainly, I think that when Trump was in power, he saw the possibility of selling a lot of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Biden came in making a great grand statement that he was going to return Yemen to peace, but in fact has done absolutely nothing except return the situation back to the same situation as Obama, i.e. he's not selling precision weapons, and he's talking about ceasefires, he's talking about peace talks, none of which have happened, and I can't see that they're going to happen. I know that a lot of people in the north of Yemen, they say to me that this is a proxy war, in as much as Saudi Arabia is fighting on behalf of UK and USA. I think there's a lot of truth in that, in as much as I think that the powers outside Yemen seem to have their own interests in keeping wars going across the whole of the Middle East. And keeping those countries destabilized for whatever reason, I'm not sure, but instability is a feature of war at the moment, wars without end that seem to go on forever, and I don't think that that the situation is one where there seems to be any urgency in the Biden camp, apart from making a statement, one of his first statements that he made when he first came to office. There doesn't seem to be any urgency in him implementing anything that's likely to create peace. And of course, ironically, one of the ways that you could stop outside parties from interfering in Yemen is by stopping the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia and UAE that are perpetuating the war in Yemen.
All right, that's Judith Brown there with her thoughts. Now let's go to the port city of Aden, which I mentioned, and see how Yemenis are actually faring there, because Aden is a port city. It should be doing okay, but the Saudis and the Emiratis have placed an embargo on that city.
The port city of Aden
guaranteeing the distribution of goods to the entire country. Maybe one reason why the UAE and Saudi Arabia placed a blockade on the country. Even that coalition failed, called a war within a war. A reported five-fold spike in deaths started the year 2021. Reasons? From COVID-19 to a variety of diseases, including hunger and cholera. This is one way Yemenis are making a living, transporting goods through donkeys. But food shortages, a sharp depreciation of the currency, and a lack of funds to pay public sector employees have plagued the port city.
It's time now for our in-depth section of this program. We're going to take a look at the numbers coming out of war-battered Yemen, which couldn't be more shocking, really. First, let's take a look at the population in that country. This is not a shock. The population has risen to 29.16 million, a little less than 30 million. Of course, there's been 300, 400, 500,000 maybe to have been killed as a result of the war. Now, in terms of the number of Yemenis that need urgent help, that amounts to 9.8 million, a little less than 10 million. Obviously, many Yemenis need basic health care, something that they can't have access to because of the bombing campaign that's happening. That number is 14.8 million people. That's almost half of the population, to put that into context for you. Now, as of April 12th, this is what Martin Griffiths, the UN special envoy for the country, has said, practically begging for the warring parties to seize opportunity for peace in the country.
The war in Yemen has lasted over 6 years. In these 6 years, Yemenis have increasingly and appallingly lacked access to food and medicine. More than 6 years with no basic services, with restriction of movement in and around and out of the country, and over 6 years of the children of Yemen being deprived of schooling and being deprived of their future. A generation has been lost.
Yeah, a generation lost indeed. Of course, you may be lost as a result of all the numbers that we are throwing at you. So let's do this. I want to put things into context for you and tell you, what if Yemen was 100 people? 100 people. And out of that, give you numbers out of 100 people as to the situation in Yemen. For example, the first item that we're going to take a look at would be humanitarian assistance, to make it simple. Out of each 100 people in Yemen, 74 would need humanitarian aid out of 100 people. Moving now next to having no access to clean water or sanitation services. The number of people that are in need of that are 57 out of 100. So you can see how severe these numbers are. Now, the next item that we're going to take a look at are people in Yemen who are food insecure and are at risk of famine. Here the number stands at 60 out of every 100 person in Yemen. Of course, these numbers, again, are very shocking, to put things into context for you. The next number is another shocking number when it comes to women. 10 of the women and children in Yemen are acutely malnourished. These numbers, such as this one, could actually now be more because the war is still ongoing. And finally, we're going to take a look at the figure that drove home the devastation of this war. You heard of the phrase in Yemen, how a child dies every 10 minutes. Why is a child dying every 10 minutes? The reason cited: malnutrition, diarrhea, and breathing infections. Now, does that give you a better idea? I hope so. Well, here is UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric on his latest look at the grave economic and humanitarian situation in that country.
Moving on to Yemen, our colleagues there tell us that the humanitarian situation continues to worsen, with fuel and food prices at double or even triple the pre-conflict averages, and the depreciation of the Yemeni rial, the threat of hunger for millions, is a reality.
Stefan Dujarric there, the UN spokesperson, who took a look at the grave economic situation in that country, not to mention, of course, the humanitarian situation. Now, we're going to bring in Mia Shua to get an analysis on that. Mia, welcome back. You are aware of the importance of Aden. So has Saudi Arabia and the UAE. They've set up a legitimate government there in their eyes. And we know that Aden is very important because most, if not all, goods that come through the country have to get distributed from there. But it's placed under a siege. What is your assessment of the situation of Aden and the embargo that both the Saudis and the Emiratis have placed there?
Yes, Saudi and its allies have the budget and the will to continue their campaign against a politically and economically independent Yemen. Aside from this, there is also the issue of Yemen's position at the gate of the Red Sea, a channel for Saudi exports and trade. Saudi is threatened by the idea of having a potentially powerful state on their southern border and controlling, maybe even policing, the Red Sea. This scenario would see Yemen carry a lot of leverage against their current aggressor. From this perspective, the Saudi coalition may prefer to continue their brutal campaign rather than face this difficult outcome of Yemeni control in the Red Sea.
Okay, thank you, Mia, for that. We do appreciate that. Now, we can cover the humanitarian figures of this war at length, but we also need to get a feel of some of the economic indicators, which also show how bad the economy is doing. Now, let's first take a look at how much money the country has lost in terms of its oil revenues. $75 billion is the figure that we have as of the latest figure for the loss of oil revenue. That figure, again, could be higher. The GDP is the next item. The cumulative GDP percentage contraction in real GDP terms came in at a whopping minus 50% for the year 2020. So half of the country's GDP to have been lost there. What does all of this translate into when it comes to economic loss as a whole? That's $88.8 billion. The war in Yemen has battered the economy there for 6 years, and it doesn't seem like it's going to stop anytime soon. What has fueled this war has been weapons, military equipment, sold mainly by the U.S. to Saudi Arabia and its allies. That has kept the war going on for 6 years now. But did you ever wonder why the war continues, even though Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to lose on the ground, like multiple attacks by the Yemeni army on Saudi's moneymaker Aramco and other military advances by the Yemeni army? Well, the reason is simple. Saudi Arabia is losing the war. It's spending a lot of money at it, too. And the Yemeni army wants to have a strong hand when it comes to the negotiations. That is why the Yemeni army is fighting to capture Ma'arib. That is the biggest district by area. Don't forget, the Saudis just recently offered a peace plan. It was rejected by the National Salvation Government because, well, it did not put an end to the blockade, which was a key demand of the government. U.S. support, once it ends, will wrap up the war. No doubt about that. But the question is there a strong enough will by the U.S. to give its order to Saudi Arabia to end the war? That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thanks for tuning in. From Economic Divide, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. In this segment, we're going to talk about famous reciters of the Quran. And of course, we're going to listen to a short piece of recitation by that famous reciter. Today, we're going to talk about the great reciter, Sheikh Muhammad Rifat. Probably a lot of those who listen to the Quran and closely follow recitations of the Quran, especially famous reciters from Egypt, know who this reciter is. It's said that this reciter, Sheikh Muhammad Rifat, is the best reciter or one of the best reciters of the 20th century. Sheikh Muhammad Rifat was born in 1882 in Cairo. Unfortunately, he went blind when he was just 2 years old. He was able to memorize the Holy Quran at a very young age, just like most reciters from Egypt, who first memorized the Quran, and then they learned the rules of tajweed, and then they become professional reciters of the Quran. We could say a lot about Sheikh Muhammad Rifat's style of recitation. His voice was absolutely magnificent. It was a heavenly voice. It was beyond this world. It was so beautiful that a lot of people would cry upon listening to the recitations of this great reciter. One of the characteristics of the recitation of Sheikh Muhammad Rifat was that he was able to move between the maqamat and the melodies of the Quran very easily. And his voice was very powerful. He could use the lower register, the intermediate register, and the upper register of his voice. He had a complete voice, meaning he could recite in the qarar, the low register, jawab, the intermediate register, and jawabul jawab, the highest register of one's voice. Sheikh Muhammad Rifat entered the Egyptian radio in the 1930s. This great reciter used to recite the Quran in Mustafa Fazil Pasha Mosque in Cairo. Unfortunately, this great reciter passed away in 1950 at the age of 68. From throat cancer. A lot of reciters followed his style, and still they sometimes use his style of recitation in their recitation. For example, Sheikh Muhammad al-Laythi used the style of Sheikh Muhammad Rifat in his recitation. Sheikh Muhammad Abdul Aziz Hassan used this style of recitation. Sheikh Kamil Yusuf al-Bahdimi was heavily influenced by the recitation style of Sheikh Muhammad Rifat, and many other reciters were influenced by the style of recitation of this prominent reciter of the Quran. Now, I invite you, dear brothers and sisters, to listen to the recitation of Surah Maryam, verses 12 to 15 by Sheikh Muhammad Rifat. Let's enjoy this recitation.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا خذ الكتاب بقوة
Allah said, O John, take the scripture with determination. And we gave him judgment while yet a boy, and affection from us and purity, and he was fearing of Allah, and dutiful to his parents, and he was not a disobedient tyrant. And peace be upon him the day he was born, and the day he dies, and the day he is raised alive.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Saudi Kingdom has ramped up efforts during Ramadan to stem the tide of charitable giving under the pretext of unifying relief efforts under the umbrella of the King Salman Humanitarian Aid and Relief Center. Of course, any aid that does arrive does not reach the most populated areas of Yemen. To make matters worse, the Saudi government has banned thousands of Yemeni expatriates from returning to Yemen to reunite with their families during Ramadan and bringing with them the money they've earned working low-wage construction and other hard labor jobs for the kingdom's wealthy. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Ramadan Brings No Relief for Yemen as Saudis Block Charities. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Adil al-Hajjaji is a proud man, but with a pregnant wife and three young mouths to feed, he can't afford to wait around for a miracle. Instead, he has taken to wandering the streets of Sana'a, gathering discarded plastic water bottles to sell to the recycling center near his home in Al-Rawda. The meager earnings net him just enough to provide his family with a modest iftar, the evening meal that marks the end of the day's fast during the month of Ramadan. The meal usually consists of bread and water, but On occasion, neighbors will bring by sauta, Yemen's national dish made of rice and potatoes, with meat blended in during more prosperous times. Before the war, Adel was relatively well off with a stable government job. He fasted during Ramadan without a passing thought about where his next meal would come from. In 2015, when the Saudis invaded and food became harder to find, he began to receive Ramadan meals courtesy of Muslim charities from wealthy patrons in the Persian Gulf. This year, though, Adel says those charities have told him they could no longer donate to Yemen due to the blockade and subsequent crackdown from Saudi authorities. The Saudi kingdom has ramped up efforts during Ramadan to stem the tide of charitable giving under the pretext of unifying relief efforts under the umbrella of the King Salman Humanitarian Aid and Relief Center. Of course, any aid that does arrive does not reach the most populated areas of Yemen. To make matters worse, the Saudi government has banned thousands of Yemeni expatriates from returning to Yemen to reunite with their families during Ramadan and bringing with them the money they've earned working low-wage construction and other hard labor jobs for the kingdom's wealthy. The kingdom has kept hundreds of Yemeni expatriates trying to return home detained at the Al-Wadiya crossing since March 24th under the pretext that their SUVs are banned from crossing the border as they could potentially be used in battle. Videos shared on social media show massive lines of pickups and SUVs unable to move, and reports are surfacing that COVID-19 is quickly spreading through the hundreds of families detained at the border. The Sana'a-based Land Transportation Regulatory Authority said in a statement recently that nearly 2,000 vehicles owned by families trying to return home from Saudi Arabia have been held at Al-Wadiya for over 20 days. Reports have also surfaced of widespread abuse by Saudi authorities, who are accused of beating stranded motorists with electrified batons when they try to hold a vigil on April 5th to protest their detainment. Even the Geneva-based human rights organization SAM, which is often quite light-handed in its criticism of Saudi Arabia, spoke out about the situation. The organization claimed that Saudi authorities have been blackmailing families detained at Al-Wadiya, forcing them to sell their SUVs for pennies on the dollar before they can reunite with their families in Yemen. As Adel Hajjaji put it, the lives of Yemenis suddenly became the concern of the international community, particularly America and its allies when it comes to oil, as usual. Ali Mohammad Taiman, Marib's provincial governor, has accused Saudi forces of using their refugees as human shields, adding that they have refused all attempts to allow the refugees to move to safer areas. The Media Bureau of Yemen's army has released a video showing Saudi coalition military vehicles inside the camp. In a move that mirrors accusations against the kingdom in different places, local reports indicate that Saudi Arabia recently reinforced its ranks in Ma'arib with Salafist mercenaries brought in from different battlefields. According to the report, the fighters were offered $2,500 monthly. $100 of this amount would be deducted for document expenses. Fighters would receive $400 in cash initially, and the remaining $2,000 would be paid to their families after the move to Yemen. Meanwhile, neither Ramazan nor hopes that U.S. President Joe Biden will reverse course have offered a reprieve from the onslaught of Saudi coalition warplanes. Multiple civilians, including two children, were killed in a recent Saudi bombing in Sa'deh, just one day after Biden announced he would proceed with over $23 billion in weapon sales to the United Arab Emirates, a key player in the war on Yemen. Human Rights Watch described the move as the U.S. backing out of President Joe's pledge.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, other life forms, you are listening to one and only Youth Station, brought to you by IRB English Radio. I am Zainab, and...
By the way, I'm Mehdi.
So, today I was thinking that people, and I'm just throwing this out there, I'm sharing my thoughts with you, right? Mm-hmm. Because you are absolutely wonderful at disagreeing with me, mm-hmm. and I value that. I just wish you were less annoying. Anyway, people, I feel, my brother, are becoming more and more aware and sensitive of the things that they put in their shopping.
Are they actually becoming aware, or are they just, they just need something to be part of, you know?
Why'd you gotta snap at
have you seen this, do you know about Sebastian Maniscalco?
Uh-huh. Please share with our listeners.
Okay, he's a comedian. Okay, I'm not endorsing anything about the person. It's just this one thing that I remembered. He's like, when you're in the mall and you've got this plastic bag and all these ladies behind you in the line, only they're like, oh, plastic. Oh, my God. And I look at the cashier and I'm like, two. Some people just want to be a part of something.
Is it so bad?
No, it's actually amazing.
To be a part of something like this?
No, it's not bad.
You know, to be aware of the things that they put there in their shopping cart, whatever that shopping cart may be. Doesn't even necessarily have to be their grocery shopping cart at Target. The shopping cart of life, really. You know what I'm saying?
No.
Dang it. You usually do. Just being more aware of the things that we consume. And I think that's super important. And I really do feel that this new generation especially is becoming more mindful of that. Dude, like just 40 years ago, they used to put lead in women's cosmetics. Actual lead. And women would slap it on their faces and then they would die. And they would be wondering, like, why?
Does lead kill women?
Stay with me.
Right, okay.
But now people are like so conscious whether this is environment friendly, whether any animals were harmed during the production of this new line, whether the human beings that are, you know, producing it are child laborers and this and that, boycott them, raise awareness, support this, endorse that. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah,
at the end of the day, it's the masses.
What I'm trying to say is that if it's real though, for example, iPhone. how many of these people who, quote unquote, support these natural life things
yet support iPhone? I think it's got degrees to it, though.
Sorry?
Right? It's got degrees to it. Like, I have a friend, right? And she legit does not use any Israeli products or even products from countries that indirectly support Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
bank?
That's hardcore. What?
Does she have a bank?
No.
No bank account?
No. She can do that because she lives in Iran. But, and I think that's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that
even
is
though,
good.
Like,
yeah.
Given the, I mean, there's this quote from Shahid Mutahhari. He says that if every Muslim throws a bucket of water toward Israel, Israel would be drowned out of the face of the world, right? Muslims are not doing that right now, obviously. But if had they done that, I mean, you can't even the Arab countries, the Gulf countries,
yeah,
are doing jack.
Yeah, George Galloway, do you know about him?
Yes, I do.
He was in the Venezuelan embassy, and I was sat there. He was giving a conference. And after the conference, the speech, whatever it was, the mic was going around people to ask mm-hmm. questions. And he mentioned something about the Jewish lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to, you know, participate because I, there are university walls around me, and I had to say something because, you know, I had to come up with a question because I had to hold the mic.
Yeah, I get it.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, totally.
So I asked him
mm-hmm.
that you talk about the Jewish lobbies, that they are like this and, you know, they've got influence in the Congress, whatever. What about us? What about Muslim lobbies?
Mm.
You know? There are two questions, but that's irrelevant. This one's a bit more relevant. And he's like, the same question was asked by Sheikh Zayed's son. And we were at a restaurant somewhere in London, and he asked me this question, the same question about lobbies and Jewish mm-hmm. Jews. And he said, I'm going to answer it similarly, and I'm going to give you the same answer as I gave him. He said that the average Muslim mm. in England is richer and wealthier than the average Jew in England.
Yeah.
Seriously. Can you imagine that in the first place? Let that sink in. And then he's like, what once... So that's put one place. The average Muslim in the UK is richer and wealthier than the average Jew.
Mm-hmm.
It's about focus.
Aha.
Where we've put our interest, right?
For sure.
Man, you killed everything. I might be part of something that's, for example, this. I boycott certain products. But then I'm not careful about where I'm spending in
exactly.
other places that I've
exactly.
saved up, or, for example, I've not put into in one place.
Mm.
But then, for example, I've got an account in HSBC or Lloyds. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, you can't really say all or nothing, right? You can always say try your best because we can't strip people away of that sense of still striving for a better cause just because their strive and their struggle isn't perfect.
Yeah.
And there are
right, yeah.
certain degrees to
yeah.
awareness and mindfulness.
You're actually right. If that's in someone's nature now,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're going to probably move on from purpose to purpose until
exactly.
they reach a very...
And I think
important
that would be
one.
Beautiful. I have
yeah.
a friend who refuses to watch Wonder Woman and Justice League under no circumstances. Guess why?
Why?
Because Gal Gadot is Israeli.
Oh, right.
And he won't. He just won't. He was like, "You're not." I was like, "You're not even paying for it." But he was like, "It's the idea of it all, right?" And I respect that. I really do. He doesn't even use an iPhone. He uses whatever phone
yeah,
that
can he afford one, though?
He uses whatever phone that serves his purpose.
Yeah, that's actually
And I think that's a good mentality.
He's
at
probably
the end
matured
of the
out of all these things, you know? He's a proper mature person.
He's almost 40, so he really doesn't have an excuse. But moving on to this whole idea of being more mindful of what we put in our shopping carts.
What do you think that led to this?
What?
What led to this? Like, what? How have people come? Is it just a trend?
Oh, just awareness?
Or is it something that's happening around us that we're not aware of and people are part of it?
Maybe both. Because the whole concept of things happening around us that we're not aware really is a trend.
Huh?
Yeah. But I've got where, how did it come from? People are just more aware now. Just it's the age of information, and when you receive more information, you're basically you're more informed. You know? No. Listen to me. When you're more informed regarding a certain subject, and your eyes are open to it, to the reality and truth that's going on behind it, that's basically all you need to interact with that certain subject, right? For the longest time, people were not informed regarding the harms of lead. They're cosmetics.
You're still over there. Are you still stuck on lead?
Because it's a big deal. Dude, people died because they wanted to be pretty.
Yeah.
You understand how sicko that is,
yeah,
right? Yes, they didn't understand. But once they were informed, they changed the manner of their interaction with that certain product.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's happening more and more because it's the age of information. People are more informed. Thus, they change their interactions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And yeah. It's trending, too. Hashtag...
cherry on cake.
What do you think when you pick up something to put in your shopping cart?
Yeah, like, do I need it? Yeah. Does it serve my purpose?
What's your purpose?
For example, shampoo, for example, you know. Is it good? Is it going to...
Define good.
Is it natural, to be honest? Yeah.
Aha, see, you do care about the environment, you little rascal, you.
No, not natural in that sense.
Then in what sense?
Not environment, my head. That's all I care about, you know. If it's natural, if it's herbal or whatever it is,
why would you not put chemicals in your head?
Because it's going to hurt my head. It's going to hurt my hair. That's why.
So you care?
About my hair. And my head, yes, absolutely, I do.
You're a horrible person.
I know.
What if this shampoo, supposedly the bottle of this shampoo, was made by some child labor workers in Vietnam? What about their little hairs? What about their little fingers?
Because I'm living in Iran, I don't have products from Vietnam, right? Or like.
I get it. You live in Iran now, and good for you. Good on you, bro.
Cheers.
You have the choice to use more humanitarian-friendly, that's not a real word, I know what I said, products. But supposedly, even in Iran, I have actual information that there's a company like Firuz, right?
All right.
And they're sort of like the J&J of Iran, mm-hmm. but without all the controversy, yeah. right? And their company only hires handicapped people in order to, you know, create a career for them.
Employment.
Support them and this and that. Do you put that brand as a priority for yourself? Or are you still going to be like, let's see what's best for my hair?
You're right. No, in that case, I will do that. Yeah, because...
So you do care. Why'd you gotta be like that? Why'd you gotta pretend like you don't?
I do care, but I'm saying I don't prioritize that as much as I prioritize
myself. Because you're
not
well-informed. Would you agree? Now that you know Firuz does that, would you not actively more move toward endorsing Firuz?
I would. I would. But I would not compromise, for example, if I know that the things that are used in... does it make shampoo? Yeah, it does make shampoo if it's like J&J. So if it's making shampoo and I know it's got chemicals and it's going to hurt my skin and head and hair and everything...
Okay, yeah, fine. That's true.
You know,
neither
I'm not,
would I.
Yeah, so, I yeah. But if I know it's something that's not going to damage... something
my hair,
that
and it
my
also
hair.
Has this pro to it.
Why not?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's there.
Do you think women are more aware, or are they more?
Oh, they're not aware. Yeah, go on. Sorry.
This is how people get shot in my neighborhood.
No way. I'm glad I don't live in your neighborhood.
I'm glad you don't live in my neighborhood too.
No, you shouldn't be glad.
No, I'm glad. I'd run out of bail money. Anyway, do you think women are more mindful of this whole idea of being careful of what they put into their shopping carts, or men?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I have no idea.
I think women, because there are more products aimed toward women. And, you know, there's a whole empire established on turning women into...
So that's not women being more... cautious of it. It's just because
they're more exposed.
The larger percentage of the customers are women,
uh-huh.
which is why women can. So that's not.
But But then at the end of the day, they're still more aware. And they're more exposed to the idea of having to be aware. And the other factor is that since this whole... There's been this movement where women are more active in certain platforms and fields. They've raised more awareness regarding... Because up to a point, I don't think men really cared about animal cruelty or what they're doing to the environment. It's in the nature of women
to be more
specific. So they put that feminine touch into this industry, which I think is very valuable. I'm not saying it just because I'm a woman, but because it was needed. You know, it's that balance that I think Allah even meant to create. Like, women, men run this world in a certain way, and then women put this certain element of compassion into it and be like, wait, maybe we shouldn't support companies that have, like, kill animals and harm the environment.
No, women are specific.
Compliment us a bit more, and then we can
No, that's it. I'm glad we're out of time.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Youth Station. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker, abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.